The Rebbe and Rav Kook, I think, are very similar in the sense that they are the two Orthodox Jewish movements that are Geula focused. That there is a story happening with Jewish history. There is a beginning, a middle, and an end. They both assume we are towards the end, and there are specific things that we have to do to help Am Yisrael, help the world get to that end mark, get to Geula.
Welcome back to the Karin podcast. Thank you so much for joining us again. And if it's your first time, welcome, welcome. We are happy to have you here. We have another wonderful episode lined up for you this week. We are being joined by Rabbi Yosef Bronstein, whose new book, Engaging the Essence, which explores the philosophy and the Torah contribution of the Lubavitch Rebbe quickly and deservedly has become a bestseller. So we are very, very excited to speak today to Rabbi Yosef Bronstein. So without further ado, let's jump in. Rabbi Bronstein, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Harry. It's an honor to be here.
So as we do every week on the current podcast, we're going to ask you just one question. Rabbi Bronstein, please, can you teach us your whole Torah al regalachat?
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Currently, in the last couple of weeks, months, and years, I've been thinking a lot about Chabad Torah. So when I realized that was going to be the one question you asked me, I was thinking from a Chabad perspective, which I'm currently in the mindset of, what is a Kol Torah Kula Aregalachas? And I realized that there is no better answer than the answer the Gemara itself actually gives. Hillel asked the potential convert asked Hillel, what is the entire Torah on one foot? And Hillel responds, What is distressful to you, you shouldn't do to your friend, which the commentators explain is really a reformulation of after the Recha Kamocha, the mitzvah of loving each and every Jew. And in terms of the way I view myself and the way I view my activities, my teaching, my writing, I really try to put Avas Yisrael at the center of what I'm doing.
That's beautiful. The Gemara itself definitely gives a good answer. So I guess from a Chabad point of view, how does it differ? You yourself are not necessarily, you definitely don't present as a chassid of Chabad. So I guess, what is it about Chabad that sort of piqued your interest? And then what is it specifically about, like, the Chabad lifestyle or the philosophy of the Rebbe or whatever it is that, like, really, you think, lends itself to that being your Torah, al regalacha?
So I grew up in an Orthodox household. I grew up, my father was a rabbi. I got an amazing, amazing education, elementary school, high school, yeshiva, learned in yeshiva at Harutzio and learned in YU for many, many years. And I wasn't necessarily looking for another perspective on life or an adjacent perspective on life. But I feel once I fell into Chabad Torah, what it gave me was a deeper understanding and meaning, and maybe a little bit of meaning and experience and context for all the mitzvos that I was trying to do anyway. Let's just use an example of Talmud Torah, which was perhaps the mitzvah I've been most engaged in terms of my time, and then teaching Torah and writing Torah. So the Gemara talks about how Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Talmud Torah is the study of Torah is a very important mitzvah. It's a very central mitzvah. And there are different formulations as to why it is such a central mitzvah. Once I got into the Chabad Torah, so one of the angles as to why Talmud Torah is such an important mitzvah and then teaching Torah becomes such an important mitzvah is because of the mitzvah of Avas Yisrael. There are other Jews that are out there, other people that are out there. You expand your personality to include them. You begin to view things from their perspective. You begin to care about them. So the same way that you want to give them material benefit, you want to try to help them out. You want to try to do favors to them. So I am not handy. I am not good with interpersonal counsel. There are many things in terms of helping other people that I can't do. But I realize that within this perspective, Jews love Torah. Jews love different types of Torah. Jews love Chabad Torah. They love Rav Kook. They love Gemara. They love Halakha. Different types of Jews love different types of Torah. But if I could try to teach Torah and I could learn Torah with that perspective, I am learning Torah to help out Am Yisrael, to help out other Jews. That just gives so much more meaning and so much more layers and context to this activity that I was involved in anyway. And that led me towards learning certain types of Torah maybe more intensely because they were meaningful for me, and then I was able to teach them to others. And when I see people's eyes light up when I'm teaching, or when I get a WhatsApp, somebody read something that I wrote and it was meaningful to them, that just means it's not just about me and my personal religiosity and my personal relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. The study of Torah and the teaching of Torah becomes a community building. It becomes a way to connect with other Jews.
If we kind of take a step back, or took a few steps back 5-6 years ago, what do you think your Torah Ragalacha would have been before you kind of got immersed in this world of Chabad?
So 5-6 years ago, I was actually in the middle of writing this book.
Okay, 10 years ago,
that it's hard to put myself in that spot. 10 years ago, I was involved in, I would say, 3 different Torah activities. I was in the Kodel in Yeshiva University, learning Gemara, Halacha, Torah, Lishma, Rav Chaim Vlozhin-esque. I was doing a doctorate in Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies in Academic Talmud under the tutelage of Dr. Yaakov Ellman. So that is the more historical perspective on the Gemara. Where do all these things come from? What was the cultural context within which it was? And finding original sources was fascinating for me. And I could explain why. And the third thing I was involved with was mostly the Torah of Rav Kook. And if you had to ask me what would have been my Torah al regal achas, it was fine Torah that's meaningful for me. I was studying Torah. I wasn't teaching so much then. I was very, very involved in my own studies. And I was looking for Talmud Torah as a way of connecting me personally to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I tried different genres. I tried diverse disciplines. And all 3 of those disciplines fit in for me in terms of my connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I guess my Torah Lagakos would be find the Torah that connects you the most and run with it.
So I suppose, you know, the academic study of Talmud, of Gemara, it is undeniably fascinating. Whether it's from a religious point of view or a historical point of view, it's you know, an endless topic, and is wonderful. As someone perhaps, you know, not an expert in these things, you know, I see Rav Kook, who talks a lot about certainly like the Jewish national obligations, and you know, he is rightly the sort of father of religious Zionism and sort of that area of Torah. But sort of philosophically, I found sort of what I've learned of Rav Kook, it is talking introspection and looking inside and building your character. Whereas Chabad, or at least certainly the Rebbe, does look at very, very broadly outwards. And, you know, obviously I'm summarizing and doing a bad job of it. What is it that shifted within you that, you know, helped you or encouraged you to make that switch from, again, I guess being a chassid of Rav Kook to being a chassid of Chabad, you know, minus the beard and the hat. But what, you know, was it a life change? Was there an event? Or is it literally, was it just you picked up a book one day and it spoke to you on a sort of a spiritual level that sort of led you down a rabbit hole into essentially becoming like an expert in Chabad philosophy?
So it's a good question, and I wonder this myself, looking backwards, what are the different steps were. I firmly believe that you were the Hashkaka Pratis, that one thing led to another. I was planning on studying Jewish philosophy in Revel in graduate school. I wandered into a class of Dr. Ellman's that led me into the world of academic Talmud. They got me started thinking more historically in terms of stage after stage after stage of the development of Torah, which is something Rav Kook writes about to the endless degree, that you could see the Yad Hashem through the development of Am Yisrael, the development of Torah. And academic Talmud study was basically doing that in a more limited way within the text of Chazal, seeing generation after generation, seeing Torah develop. I actually got to Chabad through the similarities between Chabad and Rav Kook. Mm-hmm. That I was studying Rav Kook, and I realized that a foundational book for Rav Kook was Tanya. So I found myself some chavrusas in Tanya within the context of the YU based Medrash. I wasn't looking outside. I wasn't learning with a full-blown Chabad chassid. I went through Tanya twice in the YU based Medrash, once with the commentary with chavrusas, once with the commentary of Rav Steinsaltz. I guess we're here in the Koran office. I should mention Rav Steinsaltz. And then it fascinated me. The connection, I think, was more spiritual. The ideas were very deep. It was a different way of thinking about myself, again, on a more personal level. Tanya has one parak about interpersonal relationships, parak Lamed Beis. Most of Tanya is describing the inner psyche of the soul, its relationship with the cosmos, and its relationship with God. Other people don't feature as much in Tanya as one might think based on later Chabad thought. And then from Tanya, I was wondering what happened with Tanya. I knew Chabad existed. So being me, I didn't seek out Chabad Hasidim in 770. I sought out the shelf in the YU library having to do with the Lubavitch Rebbe. And I started reading through things, and it was fascinating to me what the Rebbe did with Tanya. Obviously, there are many generations in between the Alter Rebbe and Chabad. So my trajectory from Rav Kook to the Lubavitch Rebbe was basically looking for sources from Rav Kook. I found Tanya, from Tanya down to the Lubavitch Rebbe. In terms of the shift that Rav Kook, I think one of the commonalities between Rav Kook and the Lubavitch Rebbe is that they are both very much focused on other people. Rav Kook thinks about Am Yisrael in terms of its history and return to Eretz Yisrael. Chabad, the Lubavitch Rebbe, already talks about, now Perek Lamed Beis and Tanya is a central chapter, about the, you should always view yourself as part of some larger entity. That is, I guess, one of the technical definitions of the word bittul, which appears all throughout Chabad literature, thinking of yourself not as an individual person, but as part of a larger entity. And therefore, there was this commonality between Rav Kook and Chabad. What was interesting, but what I think, what Alex, you are hitting on a true point, that the Lubavitch Rebbe emphasizes a lot more, always thinking about the other person first, on a very, very individual level. There's me, I have a neighbor. So what could I do for my neighbor? Thinking of a life of service, not maybe necessarily towards Am Yisrael as a whole, which might be somewhat of an abstraction, especially for living in Chutz Laaretz. I think here in Eretz Yisrael, during a war, living for Am Yisrael is something which we see on a regular basis, but at least in Chutz Laaretz, it might be a little bit of an abstraction. But in the Lubavitch Rebbe, maybe because he was in Chutz Laaretz, maybe because of the sources he was working from, it's very, very much my surroundings. I have neighbors. I have friends. I know people. I interact with the security guard at Yeshiva University. How could I elevate those relationships? How could I center those relationships and put them ahead of my own personal needs? What made that shift within me? Number one, I just like the sources. The sources spoke to me. It is a long textual history. I always loved sources. The Lubavitch Rebbe was a bibliophile. Everything is footnoted like crazy. And number two, maybe just a little bit of growing up. You know, I got married, started a family. You start having children, and you start seeing how life is more than just about you. You're living within a web of relationships. You need aunts and uncles. You need siblings. You need friends. It's hard to raise a family just by yourself in a nuclear family. You start realizing there are other people around than just you and the people around you in the YB's Medrash. You start thinking about everybody else that's out there, and Chabad Torah lent meaning to that maturation.
So how do you sort of mesh those two approaches? As in, if we go back to your answer to the original question of essentially an extraction of Ve'ahavta l'Rechah Kamocha, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, have we want to sort of view that? How do you mesh sort of the Rav Kook of sort of seeing yourself as part of a whole in the meta angle, whether it's the national thing, how does that mesh with the Lubavitch Rebbe's sort of like one-on-one interpersonal relationship thing? And sort of in my head, I think it's probably quite connected, which would be sort of Rav Kook's attitude towards the general, Zionist outlook. Whereas the Rebbe, and I think you explore this in the book as well, like the Rebbe's attitude towards Zionism was very, very complicated. So was that an extraction as well of like the Rebbe's view of interpersonal relationships? It is the one-on-one or the nuclear thing, or was it something like deeper than that, more complicated than that? How do those two philosophies mesh, or do they not at all? And sort of you're in a period of your life now where you are thinking more about that interpersonal thing, whereas, maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was much more national.
First, I would like to split the two questions. I'm not sure if the Zionism is necessarily linked, but I think that both Rav Kook and the Lubavitch Rebbe see this very similarly. That they might discuss the way it's done in different ways. The emphasis of Rav Kook might be much more grander and national, and the passages in Rav Kook about making sure you help your neighbor might be more scarce than in the Lubavitch Rebbe. But the Lubavitch Rebbe definitely speaks about cosmic change and changing the entire world. What he links, though, what he's able to do in his talks, and this is why he was transformative for so many people and so many Hasidim, is that he speaks a lot about cosmic change. And the Chabad in general speaks about the cosmic processes and Diyar B'Tachtonim and different levels of reality, and you're speaking about the world as a whole. But in the end of the day, what the Babish Rebbe taught is that it is individual acts of chesed. It is a single mitzvah that has that transformative capability, either because each mitzvah reveals divinity in this world, and also because in the aggregate, if everybody influences their own surroundings, if everybody has positive relationships with the people around them and tries to elevate those relationships and bring divinity to the people around them, so then eventually there is going to be a cosmic change. So it's not necessarily that Rav Kook is only speaking on the abstract, you know, national level, or under Babish Rebbe, he's only speaking about the interpersonal level. Babish Rebbe, he addresses this directly in Sichos. Sometimes I remember one Sichah in particular, where he spoke about, you know, the need to change the entire world and create a Dira B'Tachtonim, a home for God in the world. Then he shifted and said, you might be thinking, as an individual person living on an individual block, an individual street with a family, what role do I have in this cosmic process? And he started developing the Makoros, how from each individual action is so important in this cosmic movement.
Let's just dig a little deeper in terms of the Rebbe, as we talked a lot about, kind of comparing with Rav Kook, in terms of that first engagement you had with the Rebbe's Torah. Did you start with sort of a bigger picture of Chabad Torah? I mean, obviously you talked about Tanya, but often we kind of forget the generations in between. Was that a part of your journey kind of through the Torah of Chabad, or was it from Tanya, Rav Kook, the Rebbe?
So this is to my chagrin. Unfortunately, I did not go through the entire intellectual history. At this point in my life, I was not getting paid to learn this. I was learning this somewhat on the side in my own. And I was doing it for personal interest. I was just fascinated by Tanya, and I was fascinated by the Lubavitch Rebbe was doing. So I tried to read as much from the Alter Rebbe as possible, but I did not systematically go through the Middle Rebbe and the Tzemach Tzedek and the Marash and the Rashab and the Friedrich Rebbe. What I did was look back footnotes. So the Babish Rebbe cites a lot of Mamarim. He cites a lot. He's constantly working from the earlier Rebbes. So I sort of looked up things backwards. That does not give me a systematic knowledge of Chabad as a whole. And I think this is reflected in the book, that I often go from the Alter Rebbe to the Lubavitch Rebbe. I think tracing the entire intellectual history of Chabad would be a fascinating project. It's not necessarily something that I am personally equipped to do. But this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring internal Chabad Talmidei Chachamim into the picture when I was writing this book, because I realized there was a lacuna in my own personal knowledge.
And just in terms of kind of looking at the Rebbe, I guess there's two questions. We'll start with one, get to the other one in a second. But in terms of kind of the perspective on from within the Jewish world, from within the YU modern Orthodox world, how do you see the place of the Rebbe as kind of Jewish philosopher, as a thinker? Do you think that sometimes it gets dismissed as, well, that's Hasidus? Do you think people are missing kind of a piece there of the Rebbe's philosophy?
So partially, yes. I mean, I grew up within the modern Orthodox world, within the Yeshiva University community, and I did not necessarily think, and this was to my loss, of the Lubavitch Rebbe as a great Jewish thinker, as a great Gadol B'Yisrael in terms of Torah. I knew of him as a tremendous leader, as a leader of a movement, as somebody that was transformed American Jewry, but I was not exposed to the Torah of the Lubavitch Rebbe, and I assume many of my peers and many of my students and many of my teachers were also not exposed to the Rebbe as a Talmud Chacham, innovator within Jewish philosophy. After having spent time going through the material, I do think the Lubavitch Rebbe deserves a space in that great pantheon of Jewish thinkers, that it laid out a very, very intellectually rigorous and source-based Jewish philosophy for Jews in the modern world, similar to Rav Kook and similar to Rav Soloveitchik. I think the Lubavitch Rebbe definitely deserves a place on that plate.
And how do you think, or what are your hopes, I guess, and we'll start getting into a little bit in terms of the book that Alex mentioned at the beginning that you've now written and published. What are you kind of hoping that people will see from the book that might kind of change that perception of the Rebbe within the modern Orthodox world? Why was it important for you, I guess, as someone from the modern Orthodox world, to write this book to try and change that perception?
So I was not actively trying to change your perception. I taught classes in YU on individual thinkers, on the thought of Soloveitchik, the thought of Rav Kook, eventually on the thought of the Lubavitch Rebbe. And I introduced my classes with the following goal, so to speak, that I said there are three goals for learning an individual modern thinker, of Soloveitchik, of Lubavitch Rebbe, of some other thinkers, whatever it is. Number one is that it's Torah. Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam, you're a Mekayim Mitzvah, Talmud Torah, if you learn a Sicha from the Lubavitch Rebbe. That's number one. Number two is that it helps you understand another community. And this is perhaps where we're bringing Achdus to Am Yisrael comes in, that if you are mystified by why the Dati Lumi community acts or thinks in certain ways, what their foundational assumptions are, or if you're mystified by Chabad and you just get turned off by them, then you realize they're coming from a very well-sourced based philosophy. And everything they're doing could be traced back to a line in the Zohar, a line in the Rambam. If interpreted along a certain trajectory, it helps you understand other adjacent communities. So that could be a second goal. And a third goal is maybe the Torah will resonate. Maybe it'll be meaningful. Maybe not all of it, maybe some of it. Even when I wrote this book, some chapters I think have impacted my daily life, and some chapters are still remain foreign to me in terms of the actual content. I hope the reader isn't able to discern which chapters are which, but I think that's just the nature of somebody coming from the outside. You don't have to buy everything hook, line, and sinker. Maybe some people do, but you don't have to. But a lot of the Torah could still be very meaningful. So in terms of my goals of writing the book, I think it was those are the three goals. Number one is Talmud Torah. This is an area of Torah that many Jews are not exposed to. They wouldn't necessarily have a way in. This is an access point for a part of Torah that otherwise may not have been accessible to a certain percentage of the Jewish population. Number two is that it'll help people understand why Chabad does what it does. And then number three is that maybe a certain chapter will be meaningful to somebody. Maybe somebody will be having a bad day and they read about Simcha and they could integrate some of those ideas into their life, even though the book is not really a practical book. It's not a how-to book. My friend Rabbi Levi Shmatzkin wrote a fantastic book about Letters for Life, about emotional well-being in the thought of the Babash Rebbe. It's much more directive. It's much more, these are the letters the Babash Rebbe sent to people who had certain life issues. This book is more the abstract philosophy, but who knows? Maybe somebody will read it and they'll get uplifted.
I think we've sort of hinted at it a couple of times already in our conversation, but the book was a long time in production. Like with a lot of books, you know, that the author spends years and years researching and writing and teaching, and then before they commit it to paper and send it to us and we go through the editorial process, your book in particular went through a very long editorial process, which involved... it involved like Chabad HQ in inverted commas, that this is you, not a Chabad chassid. You know, you're not somebody who has sat and learned in 770 and gone out on shlichus and done all of that, but somebody who has a real deep appreciation for the Rebbe's Torah, that, you know, the people within the Chabad community sort of gave their seal of approval, I suppose, for what you've written. What are some of the things, you know, you talked about how that some chapters in the book have given you sort of a real practical, boost in terms of your understanding or your practice of different things, and others maybe not. And we won't go into asking you to list, you know, which ones are the practical ones, which ones aren't, which ones are the ones that you're less keen about. But what can a reader expect when they open the book? You know, somebody who maybe has a passing interest in Lubavitch, or somebody whose encounter with Chabad to now has been they provided them with kosher meals in some far-flung place. Somebody who's, you know, not so familiar with the Rebbe or with Chabad or with Tanya even, what can they expect within the pages of the book that might give them that sort of real like boost that you're talking about in certain areas? As you say, you know, it's not like Levi Shmotkin's book about, you know, really directing people in terms of things, but by looking at the Rebbe's approach to different areas, whether it's in Jewish philosophy or just in life in general, you know, there's a chapter in the Rebbe's approach to science and halacha, correct? So, you know, what can a person expect, and when they open the pages, like what would they find there?
So the general structure of the book is that what I tried to do is identify the major themes in the Babash Rebbe's thought, and to organize chapters around these themes. So I think the reason why this book was necessary is because the Babash Rebbe spoke around the year. He spoke on the Parshios, he spoke on the Chagim, he spoke on special days in the Chabad calendar. And he hit on certain themes, let's say the theme of Hashkaka Pratis, hundreds if not thousands of times, but it's you would have to go through each one in order to understand, gather together the sources of when he spoke about it. So what I tried to do is to gather lists of sources, a long, long list of sources. Some of this has already been done by Chabad and different areas, and some less so. and then try to find the foundational principles, the conceptual principles of the Baba Shravi Sot, and then put that or in some context. So each chapter will begin with what is said about this topic in Chazal, what is said about this topic in the Rambam, what is said about this topic maybe in the Ramban, what does early Chassidus have to say about this, and then what did the Baba Shravi say? So that way you are sort of contextualizing the Baba Shravi's thought within a little bit of the sketch of Jewish intellectual history. So you're able to identify better what was his chiddush, what was his innovation. And then what I try to do in the sections of the chapters, which is the bulk of the chapters, about the Torah of the Baba Shravi himself, is to cross-reference a ton. So that way you could see the way he thought about Hashgacha Pratis is exactly the same way he thought about the need for Shlichos, which is exactly the same way he thought about women's issues. So that way you could see there was a consistent line of reasoning, which makes the Baba Shravi a systematic thinker, and not necessarily somebody who just necessarily inspired people based on charisma alone.
Well, I mean, we touched on a little bit before in terms of kind of the interaction between events and your personal growth and life while writing this book. While the book was being worked on, you made Aliyah. And also in the book, you talk about, there's a chapter about the Rebbe's kind of understanding or reflections or philosophy of Zionism. So how did that all fit together? How was that experience? Did it impact? Did it shape the way you thought about it, approached it?
You're asking me personally? Not really, to be honest. I don't think it personally impacted my views greatly. I think one of the things that I gained from academic Talmudic studies and the whole, you know, going through a process of writing through a dissertation and then getting that published as a book, and what Professor Ellman, you know, drilled into me, is that you have to write objectively. You know, not necessarily are you going to love everything you're writing. You don't have to identify with everything you're writing, but you could still do a decent as possible job in terms of objectively gathering the sources and organizing it in a proper fashion. So that, I guess that's, I don't know if it's a skill or it's a knee-jerk reaction for me to be able to disassociate my own personal feelings from the text in front of me, at least at a certain stages, I think served me well for certain chapters. Look, the Baba Shravi was a great lover of Eretz Israel. He helped out the state of Israel as much as possible. Are his views of the significance of the state and the significance of the return of the Jewish people to Eretz Israel completely identical with mine and the ideals that my wife and I want to instill within our children? Not 100%, but hopefully it didn't impact the actual content of the chapter.
Can you tell us a little bit more, maybe as a way of perhaps giving our listeners a little bit of a taste of the book in terms of the Rebbe and Zionism? Like, how do you explore that in the book, and what was, from your perspective, would you say is his understanding or philosophy of it?
So it depends what you mean. What do you mean by Zionism? So this is where everything is complicated. So as a background, the Baba Shravi often took a very unique idiosyncratic approach to topics, which are entirely based on his understanding of the previous sources, Chabad Torah, and then classic Torah sources. So in terms of his view of Zionism, you have to understand his view of Eretz Israel versus Chutz La'aretz and Golus and Geula. So the Baba Shravi held on to two thoughts simultaneously. Number one is that Eretz Israel is a special place. It's where Am Yisrael is supposed to be. It is under the ownership and sovereignty of the ownership, let's say, of Am Yisrael. And it is a special place where there's more Ashkaka, which Hashem loves, where every Jew is supposed to be. On the other hand, Chabad, from Tanya down, has a very universalistic and global perspective in the sense that God is everything. God permeates every aspect of this world. God can be manifest through everything in this world. And therefore, no matter where you are, even if you're stuck in some seemingly godforsaken place in Eastern Europe, if you look at the world properly, you will see God shining through the local river, the local tree, the local mill, and you could reveal and consciously interact with the divinity that exists there. So those two thoughts are in a little bit of tension. Because if you read Tanakh, if you read Rav Kook, the only way for Jews to actually fully encounter divinity is if by Jews being back in Eretz Israel. That is the God's home. That is the place where Nevuah is possible, prophecy is possible, the highest level of connection is possible. And Chabad doesn't deny that. The Baba Shravi didn't deny that. But the Baba Shravi would argue that while Jews were in Chutz La'aretz, and in his day he has a letter where he says the majority of Jews have been in Chutz La'aretz for 1900 years, and we're not just here because of our sins, we're here because of a mission God wants us to accomplish in Chutz La'aretz. Part of that mission is revealing the divinity of the local place, of the literally inanimate stone, sticks and stones, and the people and the culture where people happen to live. And the Babbage Rebbe saw the fact that non-Jewish society was opening up. Jews could be more influential in non-Jewish society in the Western world. And the fact that Jews were spread to all four corners of the world in the 20th and 20th century, South Africa, Argentina, Australia, places where Jews hadn't necessarily been in the past, all these things indicate that Jews have a local mission in their local place to reveal the divinity that's there. So that is going to be in tension with the completely Zionistic view that once they have the opportunity, all Jews should make Aliyah. So that is the theoretical frame of the chapter, and then we get into the Rebbe's specific views about the state of Israel and Zionism and things of that sort. But I think that without that theoretical frame, you can't necessarily understand the way he's tiptoeing the line or creating his own line between classic Zionism and classic rejection of Zionism.
On the topic of the Rebbe and Israel and the Rebbe and Zionism, as a religious Zionist, how do you approach the Rebbe's Rebbe's ideas on, kibbutz galiyot, of the Jews coming back to Israel, as something that he didn't see as an ideal, perhaps didn't even see as a mitzvah to come and live here. And when we think of Chabad, we think, especially today, you think of Chabad and you think about talking about Moshiach, and it's all about bringing Moshiach, and we'll leave all sorts of jokes about the Rebbe and Moshiach to the side. But this idea, as a religious Zionist, seeing the return to Israel as part of the Atchalta de Geula, the beginning of the redemption, that is something that perhaps did not come up in the Rebbe's philosophy, that the age in which we find ourselves, where we're able to come and live in Israel, and as religious Zionist people, we see making Aliyah as part of that process, and the Rebbe did not. So how do you approach that? I think it's what makes the book so interesting and what makes the book so successful is that you're not writing as a Chabadnik. You're writing as someone with an appreciation for the Rebbe as a Torah giant, and to his contributions to the world of Torah and the world of philosophy. So more than just writing objectively, because it's not the same thing as an academic philosopher writing academic philosophy. This, you live and you breathe Torah, and you live and you breathe Judaism, and there is this one aspect that is clearly quite important to you. I don't want to put ideologies in your mouth, but clearly quite important to you to make Aliyah and raise your family here and be in Israel. It's something that just was not, it wasn't necessarily important to the Rebbe. I don't know. I mean, you would know better than I would. So how do you, as someone, as a religious Zionist, view that aspect? Because this is perhaps my failing. I find it difficult to be objective on certain topics because Judaism isn't just a philosophy. We're not talking, insert whatever philosophical school here. Judaism and Torah is something more. So how do you...
Right, I'm not objective about Torah. I tried to be objective when I was writing down Torah in the book. I definitely have my own thoughts about this, and my thoughts were definitely influenced by this community in which I grew up and the fact that I studied in Karen Biavne and Gush and in Merkaz Harav. And I learned Rav Kook when I was here, close to a little bit over 20 years ago now. I would say as follows, that just number one, just for the record, the Babbage Rebbe was not against Aliyah. The way I think a better way of saying it was that he was pro Judaism in Chutz Laaretz. If somebody didn't have a communal role and somebody was not necessarily active in their community, push comes to shove, if everything else was equal and you could be equally as active maybe in Eretz Israel or even more inactive in Eretz Israel, he would tell people to make Aliyah. There's a letter he sent to somebody that said that somebody from Minnesota, I think, who wanted to make Aliyah, and the rabbi told him, he wasn't the rabbi of the community, but he was an active for a member of the community, an upstanding member, and he was a good role model for the teenagers, so maybe you shouldn't make Aliyah. But then the end of the letter was like, but if you are unhappy in Chutz Laaretz and your neshama wants to be in Eretz Israel, you have no mitzvah to be unhappy. And it wasn't like he was anti-making Aliyah. Aliyah was a mitzvah. It was a mitzvah chiyuvis, mitzvah chiyumis. He doesn't necessarily go like the Ramban, like a tzvita all the way. There's an obligatory mitzvah on everybody to make Aliyah. He saw it as a positive religious value as long as it didn't contradict other positive religious values. Is that where I currently am? I'm not sure. I don't think so. But I don't think that impacts the Rebbe's own view. One other point before I get to the real answer, to my real response, is that the Rebbe and Rav Kook, I think, are very similar in the sense that they are the two Orthodox Jewish movements that are Geula focused, that there is a story happening with Jewish history. There is a beginning, a middle, and an end. They both assume we are towards the end, and there are specific things that we have to do to help Am Yisrael, help the world get to that end mark, get to Geula. For Rav Kook, it's much more focused on what's happening in the land. And for the Babich Rebbe, he had a different set of sources he was working with, and therefore it's much more focused on spiritual work that is happening all over the world. But the goal is the same, and I think for me, at least, it was an easy shift to make, because as opposed to, let's say a different community where Geula and Mashiach are not necessarily topics that are often discussed. Maybe the end of the Dvar Torah, she'll have more Yirat Shemayim, we shouldn't speak Lashon Hara, and the Mashiach shall come. But it's not something that is on top of the consciousness of, let's say, the kids in the educational system, things of that sort. I think the Tzilumi community, and at least the ones that are more connected to Rav Kook and Chabad, are the two movements that are very Geula-focused, and they take slightly different paths. Obviously, Torah and Mitzvot are a major part of both of them. Take slightly different paths in terms of what the flavor of Avodas Hashem should be in the 21st century in order to bring us to the finish line. Am I personally more on the Rav Kook side in terms of my understanding of the totality of Torah, whatever that means when I'm comparing myself to Rav Kook and the Babich Rebbe, which is nothing? My read of the sources, which I'm totally biased based on my upbringing, is more in the Rav Kook world. I think the simple read of Tanakh is that Am Yisrael returning to Eretz Yisrael, rebuilding a society here, is a major, if not the major part, of the Geula. The Babich Rebbe thought that as well, but he, based on other sources he had, and based on other sources that Rav Kook de-emphasizes, he thought there was supposed to be some type of global spiritual tshuva movement prior to that necessarily being fully engaged. In the end of the day, am I happy that the Babich Rebbe took the approach that he did? I think I'm totally happy. Because if you think about Achdus Yisrael, think about what Chabad did and does throughout the world, the majority of Jews when the Babich Rebbe was alive were in Chutzlaretz. Even today, I don't know what the current demographic parts are, but probably the majority of Jews are in Chutzlaretz. How many movements, how many people, how many communities care for those Jews in Chutzlaretz, particularly those Jews that aren't necessarily as affiliated, and necessarily being sent to a modern Orthodox day school, yeshiva diversity, or yeshivish day school and BMG in Lakewood at the end. The Rebbe's perspective on Geula and the Rebbe's perspective on Avas Yisrael, which come together, they have done such an amazing thing for the Jewish world. So the Rebbe would have sent all of his Chassidim to Israel. Let's assume a parallel universe. The Rebbe read the Makoros like Rav Kook and sent all of his Chassidim to Israel. What would have happened to all those Jews in Chutzlaretz? I think I'm not in the business of looking back and seeing and in a very specific way seeing Hashkachas Hashem in the way different Gedolim functioned. But I think if you take a step back and you see you had several Gedolim pushing Aliyah and you had the Babich Rebbe pushing, just caring for Jews and Chutzlaretz for their material and spiritual well-being, I think that spread has done tremendous good for Am Yisrael as a whole.
What do you think in the modern Orthodox world can learn from Chabad?
Can learn from Chabad. So this also, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not a communal leader. I really enjoy
it. So what you say has no consequences, so it's fine.
Totally great. What could the modern Orthodox world from Chabad? Sorry, what could the modern Orthodox world learn from Chabad? I could say personally what I learned from Chabad, and maybe I will... I'm the prototypical modern Orthodox Jew in terms of my education. I learned, number one, I would say, again, in no particular order, is the idea of bittul. Bittul is a hard term to translate, but bittul simply probably means something like always seeing yourself as part of a greater whole. So when I was in, let's say, yeshiva, I was in yeshiva at HaRetzion, my goal was very clear. I wanted to master Shas. I wanted to become the biggest Talmid Chacham I could become. I wanted to learn a ton. Did that take other people into account? People that were necessary, would that help out other people around me? Was I taking their needs into account? Not always on 100% necessarily. It was a very, very me-focused approach. And I thought it was a spiritual pursuit. And maybe, and probably hopefully it was. I think what Chabad gives you, or gave me, if you learn it and you let it, for me, let it marinate, let it seep in. It wasn't a very, very, very sharp turn. It was more of a slow marination. Is the perspective to always think about the broader circles and view yourself as part of those broader circles. which might mean a little bit more teaching, which might mean a little bit more learning Torah that is going to be going, that I know might be more meaningful to other people, even if I wouldn't necessarily, even if I wouldn't, maybe I would be learning, I would be learning something else. It means putting other people's needs before yours in a material and spiritual way, whatever, with whatever skills God happens to give you. That's one. And number two, I guess this is Chassidus in general. Again, I don't want to speak negatively about the modern Orthodox community. I love YU. Yeshiva University is still my yeshiva. I still work there. I still teach there online, and I'm so happy for the opportunity to do so. And I speak glowingly about YU whenever and wherever I have the ability. They gave me so much. Where else could I learn Gemara from Rav Rosenzweig, academic Talmud studies from Dr. Ellman, and learn Chassidus on the side from amazing teachers also? There's no other place in the world where you could do all those things, I think, at least, with a chevra for each discipline, plus it's just some very, very nice people around, even people that are not necessarily engaged in academic Talmud and Gemara at a high level. But Chassidus in general, I think, gives you a little bit of soul, a little bit of neshama, it centers the experiential elements a little bit more. And at certain parts of my life, that was a very important thing for me to learn about, to encounter, and to see the sources. Again, I was very source-based. See the sources that justify that, that looking for the experiential and not just for the purely, purely halachic.
Okay, so then looking back, and perhaps this is where we'll end, looking back at your original answer of Ahavat Yisrael, of V'Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, of, you know, Hillel's answer in the Gemara, and the time of year that we're sitting in, and you know, the expertise that you've so kindly shared, what are some practical things that the listener can do? As in, we're in a time where people are looking for, you know, what can I do practically? And you said that the book that you've written is not a practical book. It's not a self-help, you know, how to live your life according to the Torah of the Rebbe. But just in terms of, like, coming from the world, plural, from which you come, what are some things that, like, the listener can do to increase that feeling of Ahavat Yisrael, whether it's a feeling that they themselves have, or it's something that they're projecting outwards into the world? What's something people can do?
Well, I can tell you what's something that I've been thinking about, something that's been very helpful for me, something the Babatravi spoke about a lot. I have a page on it in the book, as part of a broader idea, but something which a recurring theme in the Babatravi's letters, I guess, to people of my ilk that tend to like to read a lot, tend to be very introverted, tend to be very, I know, caught up in their own thoughts, is to simply stop ruminating and just do. You know, sometimes you see somebody in need and you start thinking to yourself, it will be awkward, maybe I'm going to embarrass him, maybe I'll embarrass myself, maybe it's not going to work out. And you have a million and one reasons not to make that phone call, not to send a text, not to go ahead and just do the chesed. So the Babish Rebbe would write letters to such people and just, he would counsel them and just say, just do. You have to act first. If you have a good thought in your head, don't let, all those ruminations are from the Yetzer Hara, and you'll see the ruminations are going to cause you sadness. Doing chesed, doing mitzvahs, helping out somebody else is going to cause you simcha, so it's even beneficial for yourself. And the more you get too caught up in your own thoughts, obviously Chabad is a very contemplative, meditative aspect to it as well, but the more you get too caught up in your own thoughts and to the extent that it holds you back from actually being active in the world and doing mitzvos, which might just mean helping out a neighbor, it might just mean sending a text to a friend you haven't sent a text to in a while, it might just mean calling your grandmother more frequently, whatever it is, but just the thoughts that come in to do something good, just take them, do them, and you'll see it's going to help you. You're going to feel happier afterwards. You can help out the other person. And Shalom Yisrael, it's going to help out everybody.
Beautiful. I'm definitely going to go after you finish recording and call my grandmother. all right. So I think, well, that's a wonderful place to end. So thank you again to Rabbi Yosef Bronstein for joining us this week on the Koran Podcast.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Aryeh.
That's all we've got time for this episode of the Koran Podcast. Thank you again to Rabbi Yosef Bronstein for joining us. If you'd like to get a copy of his book, Engage in the Essence, it's available now at koranpub.com. And using promo code podcast at checkout, you can get 10% off the book, as well as all other books you might be stocking up for the Amin Arayim with. If you'd like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@koranpub.com or find us on all social medias. Until next time, this has been the Koran Podcast.
Goodbye.